Welcome to the Data Morgana podcast, the show in which we explore the future of the internet. I'm your host, Julia Jensen. I'm an artist researching the impact of technology on our society, and I'm a data protection ambassador. Data Morgana is an initiative by Public Spaces, a network of civic society organizations reclaiming the internet as a force for the common good. It's 2025. The internet has fallen into the hands of a few big tech companies. Under the promise to make our world better, more fair and efficient, they collect our data on a massive scale. But does this really make our world a better place? Or is it nothing more than an illusion, a data morgana? In this show, we're looking into hopeful initiatives happening around Europe that are shaping a better digital future. I just had a conversation with Réka Kinga Pap from Display Europe. She is a journalist and comedian from Hungary, working in many spheres in the media landscape. For example, as host of the talk show Standard Time and editor-in-chief of Eurozine. She is also the co-founder of Display Europe, an open-source, privacy-friendly and ethical pan-European media space. This is very exciting and challenges its big tech data-harvesting business models, filter bubbles, closed systems and recommenders. Réka has a very interesting perspective on the future of media. One thing that really stuck with me from a conversation was the part about recovering lost traffic. So let's find out what traffic will be lost if we leave it up to big tech and explore how to create a fair and open future for news distribution. So hi, Réka. Welcome to the Data Morgana podcast. It's a pleasure having you on this show and to learn more about Display Europe and a pan-European media space, which sounds super interesting. Can you tell me a little bit more about the founder story of Display Europe? Like what, where did the idea originate from and from what necessity did it occur from?
Hi, thanks for having me. So for, let's say older digital natives, quite like myself, I'm not even an elder millennial. I think I'm like a middling millennial. So digital native to some extent, but not from kindergarten. The story will be quite familiar for many. We used to have quite a variety of content sharing platforms. And I think with the monopolization and this expedited growth of some platforms, the smaller ones, the independent ones, a lot of others started to fall away gradually throughout the later 2000s, right? And then after the financial crash of 2008 and in the aftermath of the great financial crisis, a lot of offer just disappeared from the digital space. And a couple of digital giants grew up who practically monopolized publishing, very much publishing infrastructures. So when I started to work with video in 2000, say, five, six, something like this, there was a competition between platforms. By 2010, there was very little question whether you would use YouTube or something else.
Yeah, and I think this I heard resulted... that, sorry to interrupt, but I think I heard like in 2005, there were over 17,000 different video streaming platforms. And a couple of years later, there was only YouTube. Yeah.
And those are just the platforms that specialized in video publishing and not mentioning the infrastructures that, for instance, online publications built up for themselves, because there's a huge question of copyright, of use of content, etc. But now we are settled in a situation where I think Vimeo would be like a specialized platform for specifically, you know, documentarians and this and that. But most of this offer has disappeared simply because of the monopolization. Mm-hmm. And a very few, really a handful of these digital giants have the potential to very arbitrarily regulate and decide your working circumstances, the legal frameworks you're going to publish in, the audience you're going to reach, and also where, as an audience member, you are going to drift away, right? And this is extremely problematic, both from the point of view of the publisher who works, creates content, has editorial responsibilities, which these platforms do not take whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But they have almost no power over the decisions of these platforms. And we have seen this left and right in the past couple of years, that people who have built up an entire professional life to publish on these platforms are arbitrarily banned from one day and to another, and there's no proper appeals process. It's a nightmare. But it's also a problem from the audience's perspective, who don't really have a curatorial, I would say, don't really have an editorial and curatorial element supporting that they face diverse content. So practically what these platforms are all about is colonizing the entirety of your attention. That's not mm-hmm. good for you. That's not good for the public sphere. That's good for the platforms. Mm-hmm. From a monetary point of view, there's no professional reason to do this. And in order to colonize your attention and your time, they actually developed a sort of recommendation systems and all kinds of algorithms that are really in favor of taking you down a rabbit hole. We've heard a lot about this recently, but ultimately what it does is that it really limits your perspective mm-hmm. and it mm-hmm. offers you to decide for you. So even the promise of Netflix as a streaming platform and also Facebook, I'm going to show you everything you need to see, right? This was the implicit message, which is a gigantic lie, but it really limits perspectives. And what Display, what the founders of Display, we want to do, especially as professionals, we really want to have alternatives, not just one alternative, but competing or I would say just parallel alternatives that don't want to colonize your entire attention, that actually give the user the ability to tailor their own interests, to have a healthy relationship with the content that they consume, be it news, culture, entertainment, whatever, and have a selection of offer across a great many languages and from across a lot of borders that is chosen and selected with an editorial responsibility. So Display mm-hmm. is practically the journalist's dream or the editor's dream of what we would like to offer to an audience.
Yeah, that's super important and I think much needed in these challenging times, especially for media outlets. Coincidentally, I did an installation on Netflix algorithms myself for, I think it was 2 years ago, for the Biennale in Venice. And that actually showed that there's about 7,000 titles that should be findable on this platform every day, but everybody gets to see about 300 to 350 on a daily basis, which shows that people feel that they have a lot of freedom of search there, you know, a freedom of entertainment and to choose, where it's highly tailored and everybody experiences the platform completely different. And if I look through the lens of another person, I will have a completely different experience. And that does something with our kind of shared memory, shared collective memory, I guess. And one of the topics that I think you were addressing is that a threat towards this freedom of search is also the openness of the platform, or in this case, or in the big tech case, the closeness of it. How do you feel like, because you are referring to the original sources, right? As I understand correctly. So people can navigate to the sources instead of being kept on this platform. Why do you feel that is very important towards building these more open spaces?
So I think if we talk about a European public sphere, whose audience, a great many of its audience members are not from Europe, especially EU citizens tend to be way less interested in the European Union mm-hmm. than everybody else just outside of the EU. And this is true of a pan-European public sphere as well. But so one of the issues that you immediately confront is that the majority of readers, viewers, tend to remain in their national silos, not only because of limited language capacity, because very few people tend to speak 40-something languages, but also habitually. And those who do look for content in foreign languages that they command tend to navigate towards bigger publicity. So there's a great many English speakers in Europe, way more than any previous lingua franca in the past couple hundred years. And yet the majority of the foreign content that people consume tend to come from major English-speaking countries such as the UK and the US, right? You're immediately confronted with a problem. Neighbors even tend to read up less on neighbors than they tend to read up on, you know, the next big country to the West. And this is this results in a lot of political problems. This results in a lot of isolation. So we offer language tools and want to utilize the existing large language models for good to transgress these borders. However, what's important to us is that the publisher itself gets the credit and meets the audience. So the audience shouldn't be enveloped in this bubble that a lot of these big tech companies, including Google searches, that doesn't offer you the source anymore up top, but offers you a bunch of ready-made answers, then a bunch of promotion, and then underneath it, you see the sources.
Yeah, something that's also amplified with generative AI, where it's
No sourcing. So where's the source critique? That's the most important capacity on the internet or practically anywhere where you are confronted with any kind of information to be able to tell where it comes from, how credible it is, compare it to other sources. Facebook and Twitter have long been penalizing external links. So that basically means that if there is a source, you are less likely to read it or less likely to reach it, even be offered it. And that creates this this very thickly lined but very suffocating bubble, not just for information, but also for perspective and for personal connection. Mm-hmm. Because the people who try to remain competitive in these environments will have to adapt to these arbitrary prerequisites. And this is what we think has to have a competitive alternative that offers you reach to ideas, information, perspectives, culture, arts, that actually takes you to the source. Mm-hmm. You may not be a regular reader of a Polish language outlet if you're a Dutch, English, and German speaker, but you can develop the capacity to look out for more, and you can develop a sort of secondary competency, which in linguistics we actually call a sort of secondhand competence for consuming languages that you don't speak via technology and assessing and understanding the necessary sort of shortcomings of automatic translation that still allow you to access things you would otherwise never have a comprehension of.
Right.
And it's a freeing experience.
So Display is offering its platform for free with the promise that also it's not monetizing your data and using your data the wrong way. But I'm wondering, like, because it's such a distribution focused network, it's also linking towards other sites where there might be paywalls. How do you feel like that is important or disrupting the experience? Because I feel like this, of course, also maintaining that journalists and media organizations get, of course, a fair pay. But it might be also challenging and also to kind of equalize these playing fields. How do you deal with that?
So every outlet who syndicates their content through Display, so imagine it as a newsreader for listeners who haven't seen it before, as an old-timey newsreader with a bunch of new functionalities, you get to browse all of this offer, get to click through, but every partner gets to decide whether they provide their entire content for free, whether they have a paywall or any kind of system, or if they have advertising. Obviously, this is a concept that makes sense from a professional point of view, but as so much in publishing, especially in what I would say editorially responsible publishing, we're struggling to develop a business model that sustains it. But so is practically all of professional journalism right now. And we thought the situation was bad 10 years ago, but it has deteriorated significantly since then. So if you go to a journalism festival or a conference or talk with colleagues, all you will hear about, quite like in cultural institutions and arts institutions, funding is falling away, maintaining work gets harder and harder. And we're not talking about, you know, the star pay that you wanted to get. We're not talking about Lois Lane money from the Superman movies or those kinds of statuses. No. Even the daily practice of the most necessary public service journalism is being threatened in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And I think with not just digital publishing, but the current monopole situation in digital publishing, we need to make a big breakthrough and think about who is responsible for maintaining mm-hmm. quality content and making it available. We had the concept of public service in Europe. We still have a very outdated concept of public service media in Europe, which has been weaponized politically in a lot of places, but it hasn't really addressed digitization. So there's like a 40 years delay. Okay, mm-hmm. let's be very benevolent, 25 years delay in this. And we think this needs updating.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially in this age, which is called almost an information age, that information is still very inaccessible and centralized by commercial companies. Like we think about public spaces in our offline world all the time, but not so much on the internet. And especially, I think, in the way that news and information is distributed, that needs to claim a much bigger space in the public sphere for sure. I'm wondering, like, I read on your website this beautiful phrase, which was, our goal is to recover lost traffic. What exactly do you mean by that? I think you told a little bit about it in the beginning, but what traffic do you think is lost if we only lean on big tech platforms?
So the whole idea of the World Wide Web, developed originally based on hundreds of years of works of librarians, who I'm very fond of. So I'm the greatest fangirls of the librarian movement. The whole idea was that you would have incredible access, unprecedented access to all kinds of sources, information, entertainment, connections, and you would develop pathways to navigate this. And in a sense, weirdly, the non-convenient, badly colored, poorly designed old internet offered, interestingly, sometimes much more liberating means to navigate this. So ultimately, what we have here is we have an incredible offer, such a vast array of offer of content that people have never actually experienced before. And practically, we have a few main pathways and very little power to maintain any kind of alternative path. So we're walking into a jungle and don't know the routes. Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily trust the people who say, hey, come along. There's a really nice bush with non-poisonous berries over here, because the stuff you're eating, that's making your stomach hurt. Yeah. And with the diminishing trust in public actors, including the diminishing trust in journalists and editors, this is getting harder and harder. And I think what we must address is this lost traffic, the pathways, the wandering out of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, also the space for randomness and not everything based on data. But I can understand, like, it might be also kind of challenging because I read that you do use some form of recommending systems. That might be a challenge to recommend people things that they might be interesting in, apart from really determining that path towards the jungle. Like, how can you elaborate a little bit on how to deal with that? What do you think is the future for this balance, maybe?
So there's a core problem with digital there's a core problem with digital publishing that journalists recognized relatively early on, and I think it dawned on others a bit later. And that is that the unit of content that you offer has radically changed. The unit of content that you used to offer, let's say comparably in journalism, would be a newspaper, a physical volume that contains things that you're already interested in and things that the editor thinks you should be watching out for, you should be confronted with, whether or not you wanted to. We're still not putting a policeman beside you to make you read all of it, but we are trying to come up with a unit that's going to both serve an existing interest and use that for something greater in a, let's say, in a positive scenario. In web publishing, you have the unit of one article, an article as in like one item. It can be a video, it can, you know, whatever, a podcast. What is the greater unit that it comes with? Everybody is trying to develop series to hold on to audience, because just meeting an audience once results in very little engagement. So if you came in into, say, Eurozine, the magazine that I've been editing for a couple of years, for an article on transgender identities documented through the 1980s and through the AIDS crisis, exciting. Are you going to click through? Are you going to go and click the header and check out the other articles? No, you're not likely to do that unless I really push this onto you.
Mm.
And here, I think this editorial sort of rule of thumb of trying to serve existing interests, trying to meet existing interests, and balancing that offer with the things that professionals think you need to see has to be brought in somehow. And this is where the recommendation system comes into question. Mm-hmm. With Display Europe, it's very important to us that the user gets to tailor what they are interested in, and not just when they log in and a site asks you, are you interested in sports or shopping, which you usually see on this site, right?
Yeah. Come on. No.
But you actually get to tailor it along the way as a user every day. So it doesn't take this choice away from you and automate it fully.
Yeah, and keeps challenging your interest in that manner. And how does that then work from like a publisher side? Can everybody publish something or claim a space at Display Europe, or do you need to be a licensed broadcaster or some media outlet?
So we syndicate content from existing media outlets. So these can be TV channels like Okto TV in Vienna, who's one of our founding media partners, or you can be an established magazine like Eurozine, or a newspaper and portal like, let's say, Krytyka Polityczna in Poland. And they have an official relationship with Display Europe. So it's not like a log on, do whatever you will, and worst case scenario, we take you off type of relationship. No, it's an actual professional collaboration.
Is there also a way of moderation there, or is that like a decentralized moderation system in place?
So obviously every media partner is responsible for the content that they publish, but Display reserves the rights to decide whether something needs to be taken off, and the users will get the opportunity to flag content if they find it problematic. However, I think the main element here is that we have editors and journalists bearing a professional responsibility for what they publish. And Display has a specific focus, and that's why I'm saying Display is not offering to cover all of your interests entirely. We focus on public service and community media across Europe and all kinds of specialized interests. Because this is a level of publishing, what I would call the magazine sphere, magazine, local paper, local media sphere, that has taken incredible blows in the past, say, two decades. And people need access to these. And these outlets actually are deserving of support, but they also tend to be the commercially harder to sustain. These are usually the people in the small local radio or NGO-operated community TV who will work without the pay, for years on end because they are dedicated. It's important to them, but we can't forget that the second the circumstances to allow you to do high quality, responsible work, the circumstances start to fall away. Very few people will be able to afford to do this work without pay and without means. And we will end up with a system where only those who can afford to not have to make a living will be able to participate in media production. And that's dreadful. We've seen that it wasn't fun.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I think that's kind of one of the biggest challenges that media is currently facing. So I read that the core values of Display Europe are that it's ethical, privacy-friendly, user-friendly, open source. Why are these things so important, and how do you, how do you empower people to have control over their data, and how do you keep it open source and still running a business on that? I think that should be interesting for people to hear more about.
So I think open source software is important for a great many reasons. From a general sort of moral point of view, as a morality that is very much in tune with the sort of founding generations of the World Wide Web, where the whole idea was that people would get access to information, to means, and to self-determination. There's a very practical component in there as well. And that's simply because there's always been and still persists a very dedicated layer of professionals who are ready to share their knowledge, their expertise, the tools that they develop. They still can make a living from it because, you know, you don't have to necessarily monetize in the wildest way every kind of intellectual copyright that you ever had. And you can still make a living from it as decent work. But as I mentioned, our idea of a healthy public space is not one where another monolith is competing for viewers. So in this work, Display is being heavily advised by public spaces and developed by Faircom and the Cultural Broadcasting Archive, two Austrian organizations who both are very much dedicated to open source sharing, so much so that one of the founders, Alexander Baracic, is also the director of the Austrian Creative Commons organization, and for good reason. But we also want people to be able to potentially build their own versions of the site and build on our experiences. Very candidly speaking, 14 out of 15 media endeavors don't become financially successful. We don't know if Display is going to be financially successful 20 years from now. What we do know is that the work we do here, whether or not it ends up sustainable for the long run, which we hope it is, but whether or not it proves so, we want people to be able to build on it. So this is, again, the sort of archivist and librarian logic of accumulating knowledge and tools that should be available, because one company is not the measure of success. One company can be one actor taking a certain number of steps in a direction. And we really want to build towards a concept of the commons as opposed to a concept of ever closer individual isolated bubbles that now dominates big data. Whether or not financially we can build up a model that sustains this is yet a question. As I mentioned, we are very much of the belief that the whole idea, the whole concept of public service has to be thought over. And frankly, this endeavor for the time of development is financed by the European Commission and the European Cultural Foundation. So there are actually investors in there who think with a public service and public works attitude. And I don't think that you can build a fully ethical alternative to big tech with the kind of corporate investment logic that has driven even the most interesting and most sort of open-minded organizations towards a shareholder logic that then basically turned them into these evil mega corporations from cartoon comics.
No, for sure. I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's so interesting to also shift that narrative, but also to show that you can build very beautiful online spaces without violating human rights, because that's kind of now the dominant narrative that, you know, you should harvest data, that you should target them in order to either run a business or to create a tool that's functioning, which of course is quite mythical and it's not necessary. So I think it's super important and beautiful that you try to, or that you're showing that privacy friendliness at the forefront of your organization and open standards are working. And I hope that others will get inspired from this as well.
Thanks. You know, one way to not violate users' data is if you don't collect it and don't offer it, not even to paying customers. You can just avoid it by finding something else to sustain yourself from. And in return, we won't be able to promise the kind of this false promise of unlimited content for free, which is never true. If the content seems free and seamless, then you're being exploited. That's the rule of thumb. You don't see exceptions. Right.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
This logic of the big aristocrat who is going to provide you with something out of the goodness of their hearts. That's the stereotype that Elon Musk has maintained for the longest time. And look what it resulted in. Now, public policy madness. And interestingly, what's happening in the US in this like real Mad Max fashion is the dismantling of a comparatively dysfunctional and small supportive state, right? So compared to most European countries, including ones like Hungary, where I live, where the welfare state has been demolished with a sledgehammer, the US was still way worse, and they're doing away with all of that. So I think believing in these aristocratic overlords to do something for you out of the goodness of their heart and think of it as mercy, is a very mistaken attitude.
We
are citizens who have a right to our own privacy, who have a right to our own data, and have a right to make our own decisions. And that includes, in the case of open source, the ability to check what's going on within the site, because, you know, you can check the workings of the site, so you can make sure, if you have that kind of technical knowledge, that you are not being exploited.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there is so much more to talk about, but I think we have to leave it here for now. It's been super interesting. Thank you for sharing your stories and your vision. And thanks for being on this show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Data Morgana is funded by the European Union. Views and opinions expressed are, however, those of the authors only and do not necessarily reflect those of the European Union or the Directorate General for Communications Network, Content and Technology. Neither the European Union nor the granting authority can be held responsible for them.